His books are praised, taught, and even banned. We usually have a weekly salute to him, but not this week. No, we're not joining the ban. We are all in with Zinn. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From WeAreTeachers.com, 14 ridiculous dress code rules for teachers you won't believe are real. You want to do what with my shoes?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, that's rule number one. Did you know that if your shoe floats in some schools, you can't wear them? Right.
But okay, so it literally says that a principal brought in a water tank and was testing people's shoes.
Right. Well, I mean, principals, that's an important job for a principal every morning to walk around with a bucket to test people's shoes.
I'm picturing that right now, too.
I mean, first thing in the morning, I'm going to walk around. You know, I'm a newly minted principal. I went and I got my master's degree. And what did I learn? Hopefully, that's not what a principal learns, right? But no, these are great. So please go to WeAreTeachers.com to check out some of these, because we're not going to get through all of them. But some of them are just crazy. So women must wear pantyhose, and we will do random checks.
Just random. Like, hey, what you got there?
where does this come from? Right. Yeah. And okay, there's an assumption here of a gender issue too, right? That
yes.
These okay, what if a guy wears pantyhose? There's nothing stopping them.
No, but if his shoes,
I mean,
I'll have to
admit that they are a nice lightweight long underwear.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds like you've tried that.
Okay.
Too.
Well, and, you know, pre Patagonia coming out with the micro fleece type
of
stuff.
True.
You did things back in the '70s. You know, I mean, waterproof boots, bread bags.
Yep.
Okay.
Doing
so
that.
Look. Okay. What's one that you thought?
No pants with pockets.
Nope.
What kind of pants don't have pockets? Even dress pants now have pockets.
But why are teachers not allowed to have a pocket?
Right.
What am I going to do with when I confiscate the little toys all day long from the kids? Where am I going to put them?
Right.
I mean, they go to my pocket. Everybody knows they end up in that one drawer that the teacher has.
Yes.
But you got to put them in your pocket.
Right.
The other thing is, what the hell am I going to do with my hands during the day when I'm sitting there trying to look angry at students? I got to put them in my pockets.
They got to go somewhere.
How about this one? Ankles must be covered. That goes along with that one. Now, why?
Somebody had an offense to ankles.
What's wrong with an ankle?
I don't know. And no corduroy pants, too. That was in the same one.
Yeah, and then... If you do show your toenails, now this one kind of contradicts the floating shoes, but maybe is an answer. Mm. Only you must have your toenails painted. Okay?
Does that go for guys too? Right?
We don't know. So in today's gender rules where we're not sure they are, it may be that a guy wearing pantyhose with painted toes, or the wrong painted toes, or maybe if he doesn't have painted toes but the right pants. I don't know. I'm so confused now by these teacher dress codes. Do teachers have enough to do than worrying about whether or not they wore pockets that day? Well, and how about principals carrying around a bucket of water? Silly dress codes.
From the NewYorkTimes.com, are civics lessons a constitutional right? This student is suing for them. Alita Cook, 17, has never taken a class on government, civics, or economics. In the two social studies classes she took in her 4 years at a technical high school in Providence, Rhode Island, one in American history, the other in world history, she learned mostly about wars, she said.
And so now she's suing.
Because she didn't get smart enough in her class.
In civics.
Civics class.
Let's remind civics. That's the government class, right?
Right.
That's the one where you had to learn about the bill on Capitol Hill. I'm just a bill, and then I get, you know, right?
Yep.
Okay. So fundamental knowledge, some people think, because we live in a constitutional democracy.
Correct.
That means that we live by a set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to go out and live, should you be taught the rules? That's another way to frame this.
Right.
And this student is saying, I wasn't taught the rules. I need to be taught the rules, because just learning about dead people and wars isn't going to help me.
Right.
So Bonnie says, right or wrong?
I think she's kind of right, because I think there's things that need to be taught so that you understand what the branches of government are, you know, the economics and that kind of stuff. I see her side of it.
You see her side of it. I can tell you, though, as a social studies educator, which I am, in fact, doctor,
oh,
I can even
sorry,
put throw that.
Kim.
Sorry, I just want to throw that out there.
Yep,
but I've seen mandatory civics lessons where kids go, oh, my God, I never want to participate in democracy ever again.
Really?
Well, it's the most horrendously boring, dry subject, right? Now, that's bad teaching, so that doesn't address should the content be taught. The
right.
other problem, though, also from this approach is, what are you teaching?
Correct.
Are you teaching a bill is on Capitol Hill?
Because I'll tell you, Schoolhouse Rock did teach me a lot. If you're going to stand up there and teach me that I'm just a bill,
you're,
I get it.
You get it.
Mm-hmm.
Except for, and I put this forward, how about the laws that aren't bills that become laws? Do you learn about those? Did you even know that laws become laws that aren't bills?
Right.
Okay. So, right. So now we start getting into, so what are you teaching? Are you teaching the fantasy world of American government civics, or are you really going to talk about the fact, like here in Wisconsin, in the middle of the night in a budget, we had a legislator throw in language that made a mandatory civics test for graduation a requirement. I tried to get that boycotted by saying all legislators must pass the test first.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. It didn't go over real well.
No,
you know?
I bet it didn't.
But then I said, okay, I will have one mandatory civics test as long as the question is, how did you get to have this mandatory civics test? Because if students can understand that in the middle of the night, some podunk legislator can throw something into the budget and make it become law, I'm all for civics then doing it that way.
From yahoosports.com, Oakland University faculty distributes hockey pucks to defend against armed shooters. There have been myriad proposed counters to the plague of gun violence in America that don't address the actual source of the problem. And this seems like another one.
Why?
Come on. You're what? Giving people hockey pucks.
Come on now.
I don't get it.
We've talked about bulletproof backpacks.
Yes.
Right? You know,
yes.
Bulletproof windows. Hockey pucks. They're bulletproof, right?
I've never tried that. I don't know.
Well, they feel like, but that's actually not the proposed use. So we're
it's
not right.
You're
we're
not like going to catch them.
You're not going to catch bullets.
No.
Or we're not putting hockey puck suits on.
No.
As armor.
Mm-hmm. No.
Instead, you are going to be given, Bonnie, as a faculty member,
yes,
a hockey puck.
Okay.
When armed shooter approaches you, you
throw it
the
at
hockey
the
puck.
Shooter.
Yep. And that defends. And you're sitting there, but what if I miss?
Right.
Right? Hey, that's addressed in this article, so you got to check it out. Because actually, the intent of the puck, at least from what I can see here, it would be great to hit and knock the shooter out. But that's only, you know, consequent or one of those mere things. The real issue is that the shooter will be so distracted by having a hockey puck thrown at them.
That they won't know
what
to do.
They'll forget about the whole reason they brought a 30-clip gun in to shoot up a school.
Yep, it's the hockey puck.
It's the hockey. I mean, think about it. You walk in, you're ready to do mass damage, and a hockey puck gets thrown at you. Okay?
Yes. Okay.
It shifts your whole focus.
It does.
And you say, you know what? I don't think I'm going to do this today.
No, they threw a hockey puck
at
me. I got to go.
Right. Okay. Now, this is real news. This is not Onion.
No, it's not. And I saw, okay, I got to admit, I saw this story and I sent it to you. And I was laughing when I sent it because I really thought it was fake at first.
It had to be fake
news. It sounds ridiculous.
It's not, though. I mean, this is not. Why would they do this? I like the person that wrote this is kind of flabbergasted, too, because it's like, well, the most obvious answer is that they're desperate.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, they are.
You know, but what about sensible things like locking doors, as they said, let's try, you know, installing that. But the whole idea, like, why does this make news? And then it starts to point out now, though, really, we're not even going to now talk about sensible gun control. We're going to talk about hockey pucks. Okay? This makes you start to think about the possibility of going, is the NRA now behind funding this type of news to make people go, that's so ridiculous? I don't know. Or
it's so bizarre to me. It's just bizarre.
Well, I'm telling you what, though. I know I went out to the local sports store, though, after because I work in schools.
Yeah.
I carry a hockey puck all the time now.
She is a public high school social studies teacher outside of Portland, Oregon. She writes frequently for Rethinking Schools magazine, and her article, Co-IntelPro, Teaching the FBI's War on Black Freedom Movement, is included in the new book, Teaching for Black Lives. But check this out, though. More importantly, she is the Zen Education Project Organizer. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Ursula Wolf Rocca. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Wow, there's a lot of stuff. And I cut stuff out of your bio.
Well, you should never trust anyone whose bio is too long.
So. I'm like, when do you teach?
Well, I'm not teaching this year, but yeah, it is difficult trying to balance all the different parts of being an educator.
Well, Ursula, thanks so much for taking the time. There's so much here to talk about. I mean, Busted Pencils, our relationship, you know, we end every show with a quote from Howard Zinn called Our Moment of Zinn. We have Matt Damon's mom as a regular guest, and she's done some really interesting conversations about living next to Howard. And so the idea that we finally get to talk about the Zinn Education Project is awesome. And so for everybody out there, first of all, if you're out there listening right now, go to zenedproject.org so you can get involved right away. But Ursula, what is the Zen Education Project?
Great question. So Zen Education Project is a project that's coordinated by two other nonprofit organizations, and I like to think of Zen Education Project as sort of the child of these two organizations. And they are Rethinking Schools and Teaching for Change, both of which have been sort of putting together social justice resources for teachers for a long, long time, for decades.
I was going to say when I was teaching, you know, I definitely was into Rethinking Schools back in the early 90s when I was still in the classroom.
Yeah, and Rethinking Schools, you know, we publish books and we publish a quarterly magazine. And a lot of the curriculum that gets published at Rethinking Schools ends up at Zen Education Project. And so what Zen Education Project is in particular is an organization devoted to sort of promoting what we call people's history, hence the Howard Zinn connection.
Right.
And so, you know, our sort of central motto is that we are encouraging teachers to teach outside the textbook. And we do that by offering resources and lesson plans and activities on our website for free download. And I know I appreciate you telling folks to go to the website, because once you get there, you will see that there's lots of opportunities to get free resources.
Yeah, I was just saying, when you get there, just be prepared. You know, bring a beer, bring a pop, whatever it is you need, because you're going to be there a while, because it just goes and goes and it gets deep. And there is just, you know, and if from the taking the book, you know, people's history, and then looking at these lesson plans, my goodness, where did all this stuff?
Yeah, well, it's been collected, you know, over many, many years, though the Zen Education Project has only existed for, I think, about 11 years now. A lot of the resources are from predate that, right? Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools go way back. So the resources are a collection from over a long period of time. And, you know, sort of what unites them all is that we sort of have a commitment to amplifying groups and individuals who tend to be overlooked, you know, minimized or silenced in traditional U.S. history curricula. And so there's a sort of specific focus on women, indigenous peoples, people of color, workers, immigrants, And that's sort of what we mean when we talk about people's
It's you know, you go back to the book, the original book. I mean, Howard specifically said, I'm going to tell the story of those that were not told about. You know, workers, women, people of color, you name it. And these are people. You know, I was looking at the website, and I have it up now, and it's, you know, first one of the things, and this would be a question, you know, why the Zinn Education Project?
Yeah. And that's a, you know, an important point. So obviously we named the project after Howard Zinn, and specifically, you know, we do spend we do have a great reverence for A People's History of the United States, sort of his most famous and popular work. And we take that idea, that central, his central idea that you just mentioned, that he talks about in the, you know, very first chapter of that book, where he says he's going to try to tell the story of the United States from the viewpoint of people who usually don't get centered in the narrative. So he's going to tell the story of Columbus from the perspective of the Tainos and the Constitution from the standpoint of the enslaved. And so absolutely that's where we sort of get our sense of purpose, is that is in line with those thoughts articulated by Zinn. But to be clear, our curriculum sort of draws on Zinn but also goes beyond Zinn. So we include a wide variety of scholarship and resources. So, you know, we see our organization as rooted in the spirit of his work, but we're not simply a promotional organization for the works of Howard Zinn. So
yeah,
that is not who we are.
Thank you. Well, and thanks for saying it, because I wanted to point that out. I mean, this is not promoting Howard Zinn and go buy your latest Howard Zinn book, you know, or a new copy of A People's History or things like this. Is really for teachers, built around the idea that Howard put forth in 1980 in that original book. But to teach, and it's not just what was included in that book, but using that frame, that lens, that idea of whose story are we not telling? And as teachers, how can we tell those stories? Well, the Zinn Education Project kind of says, let us help. Does that sound too simple?
That's not simple at all. That's exactly right. So, you know, again, getting back to the our sort of motto of teach outside the textbook, we're really trying to help offer teachers alternatives to standard curricula or additions to the curricula that they are already teaching. And those alternatives may sometimes include some works of Howard Zinn, but a lot of times they don't. I mean, the vast majority of the lessons that I've written and posted at Zinn Education Project do not include any part of A People's History of the United States, but what they do have in common is that they are trying to sort of highlight, you know, the people's history, or they're trying to, in some way, surface stories that are less known or even covered up. So you mentioned my article on COINTELPRO. So that's an example where it's both people's history, but it's also a story that tends to be completely overlooked in textbooks.
Right. So, I mean, COINTELPRO, I can finally say it now. You know, teaching the FBI's war on the Black Freedom Movement was not in a people's history, but you took that and put it forward. How about just a quick glimpse? I mean, what's going on if I'm a teacher? Why do I want to teach the FBI's war on Black freedom?
Yeah. Well, I think one, I mean, it's to understand that lesson in particular. I would certainly have to be paired with lessons, which we also have at Zinn Education Project, on the Black Panther Party and sort of how promising and radical their critique was of the United States and how threatened the United States government felt by that critique. And at the same time, to show that it wasn't only the Black Panther Party, which is most famously people know was targeted by the FBI, but also traditional civil rights organizations, or what we now view as traditional civil rights organizations, like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So King's organizations, these nonviolent organizations, were also targeted by the FBI and illegally surveilled and harassed by the FBI. And, you know, I just think it's important to not let our history of the civil rights movement be hijacked by, you know, Hallmark holiday card writers, because we are in the midst of another surge of activism, and I would want my students to understand the sort of historical patterns that exist between activists and the government, which sometimes seeks to silence them. So that would be a quick justification for teaching it. It's also just bomb history in terms of there's all these declassified FBI documents that you get a look at. And
okay, so there's right. So that's what I was gonna say. So there's documents. There's other people's things. There's all this stuff going on in this lesson that you put together. We were talking about Sam Weinberg, who's this academic guy who likes to write about historical thinking and put out a new book, but then really took issue with Howard Zinn's A People's History and kind of put it out there as just another crappy textbook. And Ursula, you came back and said, you know what? I'm going to write what Sam Weinberg gets wrong about teaching Howard Zinn's A People's History. So what does Sam Weinberg get wrong about teaching A People's History?
Well, so to be clear, I have not read Weinberg's book. So my piece was really just a response to this excerpt that he published in Slate, where, as you mentioned earlier, he sort of claims that the history that's dispensed in A People's History of the United States is as dangerous as the history in textbooks. And he would say maybe even more so because it speaks to students' hearts in a way textbooks don't. And so my biggest beef with him was that he asserted something to be true, you know, that he kind of provided no evidence for, and that was that teachers nationwide were simply replacing their textbooks with A People's History.
Wait, a historical thinking evidence-based dude didn't provide evidence? Wait a minute. How dare... I mean, you know, in the weird kind of academic circles, I mean, Sam is, you know, this historical thinking guy, well-published, and has spent most of his career talking about teaching historical thinking and the use of evidence. So I think it's rather funny that in the... And as you said, it's not the whole book. It's an excerpt where he really goes after Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. But in the critique, there's no evidence.
Exactly. And so, you know, he didn't provide a single example of a real teacher who was using A People's History, a real classroom where the kids were having this sort of dangerous education that he described, a single lesson that maybe would mischaracterize an important historical event through the use of Howard Zinn. So there was no sort of evidence. And then I, as sort of a classroom teacher who's taught for 18 years and taught with a lot of teachers over those years and is involved in education, you know, activism, I know a lot of teachers. And I don't know a single teacher who has simply replaced their textbook with Howard Zinn or even has the opportunity to do that. I mean, there may be teachers who would want to.
Of course there are teachers that want to, Ursula. I mean, they want to use something, you know, other than the crappy United States history textbook I was given when I was teaching fifth grade that essentially told kids the same old nonsense. But, you know, I do want to give listeners, though, a sense of Sam's critique, and you put this in your article, but, you know, his problem is that Zinn, quote, speaks with thunderous certainty, and that his power of persuasion extinguishes students' ability to think and speaks directly to their hearts. Many teachers view A People's History as an anti-textbook, a corrective to the narratives of progress dispensed by the state. But in actuality, A People's History is closer to students' state-approved text than its advocates are wont to admit. So there it is. I mean, for me, that's where his whole issue is that, look, this is just the bad patriotic textbook flipped upside down, and you're force-feeding kids another form of rhetoric and or propaganda, possibly, and you're never asking kids to think. And
Go
ahead.
I think that, you know, there's a piece of that I agree with, which I do agree that A People's History of the United States is a corrective. But I also think that cannot possibly be an indictment of a historical text, given that that's what history writing is, right? There's a long tradition of history writing being this sort of contested terrain where, you know, there's ongoing revision at the heart of sort of historical scholarship. And the example I use in the article is to mention, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction, which was an incredible correction or corrective to the Dunning School's version of Reconstruction, which was totally inaccurate and full of sort of, you know, white supremacist ideology. And I don't think that Weinberg would say we should throw out W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction because it was responding to, you know, a historical tradition and historical texts that had come before it. In fact, I think when he talks about wanting to teach kids how to think historically, you have to show young people that there are these arguments that are taking place between scholars within the scholarship. And again, I think his critical error is that he's assuming that we teachers, who he never mentions in the text, that we are simply replacing textbooks with Zinn, which is not the role they play in my classroom.
One, and that's the part, right? It's like, okay, Sam, I can deal a little bit with the potential critique of a teacher using a single textbook and the possibility that, you know, Howard Zinn has a slant, although as you point out, and as Howard in right away points out, that he purposely tells everybody that he has a position on why he's writing the book, which is already very different from any type of textbook that you're going to get. But the idea here, though, that the critique, the assumption that teachers are just spoon-feeding Howard Zinn the way they were forced to spoon-feed, you know, the American dream or American narrative, the American patriot, whatever textbook, god-awful textbook we had to use. Instead, though, and I've used it as a social studies methods professor as an entry point into the idea of additional narratives.
Exactly. And it's, you know, in my classroom, we look closely at Zinn. We look closely at textbooks. We look closely at the work of other historians. And we compare sort of how they tell the same story, how they tell the story of Columbus or the U.S. war with Mexico or the abolition of slavery. And by doing that, you know, we're surfacing for kids sort of the mechanics and the guts of history writing. They can begin to see how all the choices that historians make about which sources to cite and how to cite them and how much space they're going to spend on a particular episode or event or individual, how all of it matters in terms of the story we ultimately get at the end. So I just think the most ironic thing about Weinberg's critique is that, you know, he's saying that what he accuses teachers like me of not doing, that is teaching students historiographical thinking, is precisely what I'm doing when I use it in my classroom.
Yeah, and I don't know how anybody doesn't automatically move into that kind of area when you're a teacher, as a history teacher, when you pick up Zinn, when you pick up James Lowen and things like that. Yes, they're textbooks, but they automatically position you that, when you might say it's a counter narrative, but automatically you start asking, at a minimum, and this is sometimes for me, this is the biggest exciting thing I see on potential future elementary education students, is why didn't I ever hear this before? I want to know more. And then they're now ready to start talking about historical thinking, narratives, evidence.
Absolutely.
Right? It's like, what? How can you just take, and anybody who critiques any type of curriculum, just like, curricula is neither, you know, good nor bad. It's the teachers who breathe life into it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that one thing that Weinberg also sort of, you know, he mentions, but in quickly and sort of dismisses, is just how deeply important it is that we have, you know, stories of women and workers and people of color and immigrants and grassroots resistance, how important that those stories are in our narratives. And so while I'll say, yes, I'm comparing Zinn, you know, to other texts, I also am making a value statement in my classroom by including narratives that include those groups that, you know, I'm certainly going to not apologize for, that I would advocate for, you know, till the bitter end.
And yeah, I was gonna, thank goodness you're not apologizing, because that's at the heart of this. And, you know, and great, Sam, we do want to teach historical thinking, but at this point, if we now can't move beyond, you know, objectively teaching kids to think critically by the use of evidence and the fact that history is in one way always, quote, contested, and maybe more importantly now, though, the fact is that the idea that we need to present, you know, students with a vision of what, you know, either slave narratives, children who were workers, women, the idea, particularly in American society, that we think we want to, you know, move away from that purposely. I love what you say about this, is to say, I don't, as a teacher, just like Howard makes no apologies for why he wrote this, I make no apologies for bringing students face to face with this content, because they need it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they deserve it. They deserve these stories. You know, I think about that a lot with, we just had an election yesterday, and I'm not in the classroom this year, but I think about, you know, what would I want to emphasize, you know, for my high school students who were super politically engaged and maybe were feeling blue that, you know, Gillum or Abrams or Beto didn't win, since these were such high profile cases. And I think I would try to, you know, emphasize the activism, you know, that made that even a possibility that those folks would be, you know, in contested political, you know, elections in states like Texas and Georgia and Florida, you know? So, well, I think they deserve stories of activism and of people.
Absolutely. Well, check it out, zinedproject.org. Ursula Wolf-Rocca, you totally busted pencils.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Awesome. Thank you, Ursula.
Educated educators talking education.
We are busting pencils.
Arkansas to revive book banning. That's right, book banning. Representative Kim Hendren introduced legislation last week that would prohibit any publicly supported schools from including in curriculum or course materials any books or other material authored by Howard Zinn. That's right, no more Howard Zinn in Arkansas. Why, you ask? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? Because of his blatant disregard for authority and his unpatriotic prose that denies every American citizen the truth about American exceptionalism. Reading and teaching anything by Howard Zinn must stop if America is ever to be great again.
Wait a minute, Tim. What are you doing? What are you talking about?
What?
You're reporting this as if it's actual news? You're colluding with the devil.
Wait, is this...
This is Nancy. This is Matt Damon's mom, Nancy Carlson Page. Matt, we lived next door to Howard Zinn when he wrote The People's History, his most famous book. He gave it to us. I read the first chapter to Matt. He was 10. It changed his life.
We can tell it.
He read it to his fifth grade. Anyway, that's a violation of the First Amendment. Censorship.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
You know what? I knew there was a good reason why we had you on the show. Thank you for setting me straight, Nancy, Matt Damon's mom, Carlson Page. My goodness. How was I thinking this was good stuff? Thank you.
You've got to be careful, these days when you read the news.
Okay,
because
well,
a lot of people are normalizing some pretty strange things.
Well, there's a lot of what they are calling alternative facts out there nowadays.
Yeah, that's right. And I was kind of hoping this was an alternative fact. Because this person, whoever it is, Kim Hendren, this representative, obviously doesn't know the Constitution.
Well, that's one of the first things I thought about when I saw it. I was like, okay, book banning. We're pretty sure that's outlawed. And the idea that publicly funded schools particularly are where we're not, you know, targeting specifically 95% of the American population who go to public schools. So in Arkansas, will be denied the right for any curricular materials, anything written by Howard Zinn. What's behind this, though, Nancy? Let's be real. Why attack Howard Zinn material? You just said he was your next-door neighbor. You read A People's History to Matt when he was 10. Matt obviously turned out all right, although Jimmy Kimmel doesn't like him that much. But
and I only read the first chapter because you should read A People's History. I read the entire book, and I hope everybody does. It's an amazing book that is told from the perspective of disenfranchised people. Feminists and laborers and enslaved people and anti-war activists. It's a remarkable history book, and it's all these firsthand accounts of what people experienced in history that's never been documented in one place before. It's an incredible book, but Howie wrote about 25 books, and he wrote 4 or 5 wonderful plays. So that's a lot of stuff to ban, for one thing. They're going to be very busy. And furthermore, there's the Zinn Education Project that I hope listeners know about because it's wonderful curriculum materials based on Howard's work for middle school and high school. Thousands of teachers are accessing this material online these days and finding all kinds of creative ways to use it, even in this kind of restrictive ed reform environment.
Well, here's what I like, though. Did you see this part, though? Right now, if you live in Arkansas and you're a teacher, they're giving away A People's History of the United States to you if you're a teacher in Arkansas.
Who is?
I think it's the Zinn Education Project. I have to double check, but I
you know what? So that is so funny because if Howie were alive, he died in 2010. He would, well, A, he had the best sense of humor of anyone I've ever known in my life, but he would think this is funny.
Okay.
He would make a lot of jokes and say that this was a great endorsement of his books.
Right. Well, I mean, this is the best way to get a good, you know, to beef up sales is to have your book banned.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
A part of your past, you knew Howard quite well. In fact, you were neighbors?
Yes. I moved next door to Howard and his wife, Roz, many years ago. That would be like 1972 or 3, and something like that. And we became very good friends, but Howard and I actually became best friends. And for many years, that's what we said. We were best friends, and we hung out together. Can you imagine hanging out with Howard Zinn? I was a young person really eager to understand many things about politics, economics, international issues and things. And, you know, we just spent a lot of time talking about the world. And I learned so much from him. Howard was really, really critical in shaping me, what I think, who I am. He's a very moral person. He understood that morality was critical in making decisions about things in the world, that it wasn't just that you're smart. He understood a lot of people are smart, but they do many things that hurt others and are bad for, you know, for the world. And he thought that moral orientation was really a key in being a person who was going to move towards social justice and make the world a better place. But Howard Zinn was also somebody who could have a really good time.
Okay, because I was going to ask you about the, you know, were there, you know, backyard deck parties in which Howard Zinn and Matt Damon's mom and a young Matt Damon are hanging out?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
What's
Howard
that like?
Zinn and Matt Damon's mom and Matt Damon and Kyle Damon, we hung out. We hung out in the backyard. And we cooked out and we sat at the picnic table and we laughed and laughed, because the thing about Howard that you might not know is of anyone I've known in my entire life, Howard had the most extraordinary sense of humor. A sentence didn't go by without Howard turning into something funny. And he was the most creative person with humor I've ever encountered. And I used to try to study how does he do that, but I couldn't ever understand it. It was so original. And you could just be having a normal conversation, and he'd somehow flip it upside down and make it funny and kind of transformational in the process. But Howard never made fun of other people. He didn't criticize other people. Actually, he was a person, an enormously generous soul. He really did not spend time criticizing other people. He focused on the positive. I can't tell you how positive that man was. No matter what, he stayed positive and really believed in people and really believed in social change and really believed that people were capable of understanding what the world needs and making the world better and changing their views if they heard the information they needed to hear. It's enormously positive, but such a fun person to be around. You're always laughing when you're with him and at the same time learning a lot.
But what about when the boys, like Matt, you know, threw a ball over in his yard, though? Did he keep it?
No, but he actually brought it back. Oh, there's so many funny stories about him. Once I looked out the window and he was painting his car. He had a little blue Volkswagen, and it had some rust on it, and he had a little can of blue paint, and he was painting it. And then once my son Kyle got locked out of his bedroom and Howie got a ladder and broke in the window for us. And, oh, no, he played with the kids. I mean, he threw the ball with the kids in the yard. He had a grandson about the same age as my kids, so my kids would go over and play at Howie and Roz's house with their grandson, Will Kabat-Zinn, who's, you know, John and Miley Kabat-Zinn?
I know John Kabat-Zinn, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's Howie's son-in-law.
I did not know that.
So, yeah. So
he's taught me a lot.
Johnny.
I've read a lot of his mindfulness meditation. I took a full workshop on his meditation techniques.
Yes, I have too. And I took yoga from him, and I'm also very, very fond of Myla, his wife. They're a beautiful family. They have three kids, and so our families all knew each other and there was a lot of love and respect all the way around. But, you know, I hung out with Howie. We watched Red Sox games. He was a huge Red Sox fan. So we watched baseball games together, and we went oystering together at the Cape. He loved collecting oysters and cleaning them and eating them raw. And that's something he did every single day he could on the Cape. They had a little house in Wellfleet. And, you know, we just spent, and he's a very cultured person. He loved going to theater. He wrote plays also. He loved going to movies. He loved talking about pop culture, too. And so he was a very multidimensional person, not just an intellectual, and many people know him, you know, as a serious radical intellectual scholar, which he was. But he was much, much more than that. And then one other thing I'll mention is that he had the most beautiful way of speaking to everyone equally and treating everyone equally. And that's because it truly came from who he was. So a lot of times I went out to lunch with him, and we'd have these long lunches. Sometimes my husband Doug and Roz were with us. Sometimes it's just the two of us. But we were always talking politics because we were all interested in politics. And what would happen is the waiter, this happened many times, a waiter or a female, a waitress, but I'm thinking in particular of one occasion, would be just, you know, pouring the water and serving the food. But the conversation, because of Howie, was so interesting that the person would be standing next to the table for a long time listening instead of, like, doing, you know, carrying on their waiting job. And it was so funny because eventually Howie would include the person in the conversation. Like, what do you think? And bring the person in, and then the person would be participating. Howie was very well known, so when we'd go out to lunch, many times he was recognized.
Sure.
So it was just people wanting to listen to what he had to say. But he was so inclusive. And even when a waiter or waitress would come over at first, he would look at them directly in the face. He would ask them something, or he'd make some joke or something to make a connection. He didn't just order you know, a fish sandwich. He connected with the human being first.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
History can come in handy. If you were born yesterday with no knowledge of the past, you might easily accept whatever the government tells you. But knowing a bit of history might make you skeptical, lead you to ask questions, make it more likely that you would find out the truth.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk, Busted Pencils Radio.